Welcome to the Marketplace Roundtable podcast. We speak with Seeking Alpha marketplace authors about their investing styles, their views on the market, and their favorite investing ideas. I'm your host, Nathaniel Baker. Before we begin, a quick disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. A full set of disclosures will be provided at the end of this podcast. For reference purposes, this podcast was recorded on Tuesday, November 26th, 2019. Today, I am joined by longtime contributor to SeekingAlpha.com, Richard Berger of Engineered Income Investing. Now, Richard has been active on Seeking Alpha since 2013, though he's been reading Seeking Alpha for a little longer than that. And he's been investing since the age of 12. He is the founder of the Engineered Income Investing Service, a premium research service featuring the YDP screening tool here on Seeking Alpha. Richard has an interesting background as a geologist, and he draws on his years in the oil and gas industry to hone his investing and risk management skills. He's developed a three-leg strategy whose goal is to produce income and yield at reduced market risk. A subscription to the Engineered Income Investing Service gets you exclusive ideas, direct access to the author, and exclusive access to the subscriber community. You can find out more about this service on Seeking Alpha by searching for Engineered Income Investing. Okay, let's get into it. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
Great to have you live from Brazil, if I understand correctly, right?
Yes, I'm at home in Brazil this month.
Very cool. So let's start off, and I touched on it at the outset. Your investing strategy is to produce income with the goal of reducing market risk. And so maybe you can tell me a little bit about that to start with.
Sure. I started to develop engineered income investing strategies when I took early retirement back in 2009. And like any retiree or income investor, my goal is to get a nice, healthy, high yield with as low a risk as possible. To do that, I first identify high-quality companies to invest in. Think of dividend aristocrats and the equivalent thereof, things that are really very solid long-term with safe dividends. Mm-hmm. The next step I have is to appraise fair value, and I use multiple tools for this so that the more tools I get that agree on a value range, the higher the confidence we can have in the valuation. Once I have a quality ticker target and I know its value, it's a simple matter to look at the current market price to determine whether it's at a bargain price, below value, near fair value, or up in a bubble, so that I'm either going to wait until that bubble bursts, or I'm ready to buy now, and then it's very simple to make the decision. And I further use an option strategy then, writing covered options to follow that strategy so that I'm paid to wait if it's in a bubble, instead of most retail investors would just sit on the sidelines with their cash idle. I get paid by writing covered cash secured puts so that I'm paid while I'm waiting for the stock to drop to the price where I will be willing to buy it. Once I own a stock, I'm harvesting the dividends, as is my main objective, and I'm writing covered calls to boost the income again with additional option premiums until it rises into my selected bubble target when it's up high enough that I feel it's in a bubble for value. Where that strike price will then call it away and it self-liquidates, adding intrinsic gain to my dividends and option premiums. And I can start the cycle all over again in that stock or move on to a different ticker that's more attractive at the moment. I maintain a portfolio of 20 to 30 of these at any given time.
Okay. What markets do you invest in? I mentioned you're in Brazil. Is this mostly U.S. markets, Western? How does that work?
Yes. Virtually everything is U.S. market on the major U.S. exchanges.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So what else do you do to as far as screening and picking your investments? You mentioned that you like Dividend Aristocrats. Is there anything else, any other hallmarks that you have?
Yeah, my screening criteria is generally at least 10 years of continuous dividend without a cut. I'm willing to bend and allow for one cut, for instance, in the 2008-09 financial crisis. I understand companies, even good solid companies, out of an abundance of caution, cut their dividends quickly to be prepared for any situation. And I have to respect that. So, in that circumstance, I do give a little flexibility. On the other hand, I am particularly impressed with companies that were able to go through the global financial crisis without having to cut their dividend. They get a little extra notch up. There are eight companies that I call my dividend zombies that are unkillable, that have more than 100 years of record of paying a continuous, unbroken stream of dividends. They've been through every market cycle, world wars, global famines, changes from literally the horse and buggy to the space age. The companies have shown they can adapt and continue to thrive and pay dividends.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly they're committed to dividends with an unbroken history that long. So that's another rough screening criteria. Beyond that, I, of course, monitor the financial valuation tools. Not only tell me value, but they help identify which financial metrics a company is sensitive to, whether it be their revenue streams, their operating cash flow, many possibilities. Once I've confirmed which financial parameters correlate well between value and historic trading price, those are the canaries in the coal mine that I want to monitor going forward to make sure that the company remains healthy. Being dividends that I'm interested in, these tend to be cash flow parameters.
Very interesting. Okay. You've been doing this for a while. I touched on it at the outset. You started at age 12. I want to ask you about that. But what's one thing that you would say that you've learned in this throughout this experience of investing?
The biggest key probably is it is absolutely impossible for anybody to predict the future. Nobody has a crystal ball. Mm. The best we can do is make sure we're paid up front now, dividends, option premiums, and that we know what parameters to monitor going forward for those canaries in the coal mine. Even though there will be some surprises, you need to manage risk mainly through diversity, holding at least 20 to 30 stocks in your portfolio. So yes, there will be a couple that, even with careful monitoring, still have a surprise and have big troubles. But on the other hand, there'll be a couple of really outstanding outperformers that help carry the slack of those that lag. Mm-hmm. Overall, avoid trying to seek out home runs. They're few and far between, and for every home run you do hit, you'll have far too many failures trying to chase that goal. Mm-hmm. So high quality and grinding out that income, and that's the key to successful investing.
Right. It's been an interesting year in markets. As we record this in late November, 2019 is about to be completed, although there are some potential interesting things that could happen in December, of course. But what is something that you've learned over the past year, would you say?
That's a good question. I've pondered that a bit. Markets really are, again, difficult to predict for the short term, for months or a year or two out even, but their overall behavior is easy to anticipate. Over the long haul, markets will rise. It's true throughout history. Clearly, statistics show, and I've written articles laying out the full statistics, that in the long haul, the broad market indexes, the S&P 500, will gain at least 8% a year if you average it over long enough windows. That would be over a 15-year or longer period. So if your investment window is 15 years or longer, you can use an 8% number as your expected yield, total annual average yield. For shorter terms, you got volatility increases greatly. So again, part of risk management is your investment window, how long it is.
Yep. And what kind of a window are you operating with typically?
Well, now what we're doing, because we're focused on income investing, we're actually dealing with fairly short windows. Typically, the contracts we're writing are anywhere from 15 days to 90 days. Occasionally we'll stretch them out to a year, sometimes even 2 years. Those are very rare and generally, frankly, indicate something's gone wrong and we're buying time to recover. By going out longer, we, of course, our total absolute option premium is greater, so it helps get us back from being underwater. And it also does allow that longer time for recovery. I'm pleased to say that in all cases, we have been successful in recovering. We've never had a permanent loss if we've stuck to it in our targets. There are two exceptions to that, but they were not engineered income. They weren't income investments. They were more speculative and more aggressive, and I had warned anybody when I presented the ideas that, in fact, that was the case. And unfortunately, in both cases, those were important warnings because they did work out to be total disasters.
Is there anything you're looking for in the next, in the coming months? Obviously, it's been a pretty good year for equities in general. The S&P is up, and a lot of these value stocks have benefited also from what some are calling a rotation back into value. But are you looking for anything in the coming months?
I expect interest rates to remain low. Even the U.S. now has been talk of negative rates. I don't really expect them to go negative, but I expect interest rates to remain low. The Fed apparently is going into quantitative easing forever now with just intervention in markets as they deem necessary. That's not a healthy thing for markets, but frankly, it so far has worked quite nicely for investors. Because, again, the way we build our strategies, we're not waiting for something on the come. We're getting it right up front. We know what our dividend is going to be. We get paid our option premium right up front. If we're writing cash secured puts while we're waiting for it, we've already built in downside on the market because we've got a strike price below market, 5, 10, 15% below market, for the stock price to come down to us before we're an owner. And meanwhile, we're getting paid 12, 15, 20% yields by the option premiums on our covering cash for that to happen. So we're quite comfortable. Once we own the stock, we've got a 2, 3, 4% dividend, and we're again boosting it through another 8 to 15% option premium on an annualized basis and generating a good return on our money. Again, because we've our dividends and our option premiums are always positive, so we're constantly lowering our net break-even point. And the cash we're harvesting is always positive in building towards a total net return. This is one of the reasons we have a built-in recovery mechanism. Even when a stock goes underwater on us, every month we're rolling and writing new contracts. We know we're generating a positive income element that's helping take us out from underwater. Well, we're generating income to live off of at the same time. Mm.
Cool. Okay, Richard Berger, I want to drill down a little more and get some more ideas from you, and including some stock picks when we come back. But let me first take a short break. I am speaking with Richard Berger, who runs the Engineered Income Investing Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for the service either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Engineered Income Investing, or by typing Engineered Income Investing or Richard Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. Okay, Richard, welcome back. Before we get into specific stock picks, I was curious to ask you, you have a pretty unique background. How does a guy who goes from being a geologist that looking at oil and gas sites in Africa, I believe, to winding up in Brazil and being a investor and running this marketplace service? So maybe you can tell our listeners a little about that.
Well, folks tell me I've led an interesting life, and I guess I have to agree that's true. Oil and gas, I rose from being a field geologist through various staff levels to where I was the chief operating officer of a Fortune 200-sized company, all their oil and gas subsidiary operations. The largest thing in managing an oil and gas exploration program is risk management. Hmm. Any given individual exploratory well has a very high risk to it, especially back in my days. It's gotten lower risk, especially with shale oil these days. The key is to stay in the game long enough and to have a portfolio of exploration prospects so that the successful ones will more than pay out your cost of the failures, the unsuccessful ones, and bring you a reasonable profit so your entire program has a good return on it. Those same principles can be applied to investing, and I have applied those. Mm-hmm. Having started out young as an investor, I learned all sorts of lessons in avoiding going after those home runs. For every Google or Apple, there's 1,000 companies that have gone out of business. Plus, your timing has to be just right on those. Look at Apple. Many people went broke multiple times in Apple before it became the solid ongoing success it has. So these lessons incorporated along with my experience in but managing the risk in oil and gas have been made me a natural investor, I think, avoiding and how to manage that risk through a diversity time. Mm-hmm. and risk being managed on the total portfolio level. Mm-hmm. You don't manage risk on the individual investment level, one stock, one project in an oil and gas. It's impossible. Again, you can't predict the future. You can estimate what may happen, but you can't know the outcome in advance. So there's no way to control risk on an individual basis. You've got to manage your risk at the portfolio level.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, man, ending up in Brazil, I had known from my first job out of college was a year in Portuguese West Africa in Angola doing exploration geology. And that exposed me to the expatriate living lifestyle and all. And I knew even early on then that eventually I'd want to retire expatriate, which when I opted to retire early in 2009, Brazil was a natural fit because I had learned my Portuguese in Angola, which was a Portuguese colony at the time. So it was high on my list. And ultimately I found the house here I really love on the lakeshore near Rio de Janeiro. Hmm. And so here I am these days. I spend half my time at home and half my time traveling the world, alternating 3-month cycles.
Not bad. And you're able to get reliable internet access everywhere you go?
Yeah, as long as I've got the Wi-Fi connection, mm-hmm. I can work wherever I am, and that's no problem. I've been as far away as the distant lands of Macedonia, mm-hmm. in the middle of nowhere, which you'd think would be pretty hard to get an internet connection, but it actually turns out they have the highest density coverage of broadband, high-speed broadband in the world, because they never had a phone system. So their very first communication system leapt forward to the most advanced technology there is. Right. So 97% of Macedonia is covered by high-speed, at that time, was back in the 8 or 9 years ago, was 3G internet. The very first system they ever had.
That's amazing. Very cool. Okay, so do you invest in oil and gas companies now?
I actually am actively avoiding oil and gas companies now. My opinion is the oil industry is in the earliest most phase of the end of oil as an energy source.
Huh. That's interesting. And you have reasons to believe that, actually, because you've worked in the field.
Yeah, actually, I received Seeking Alpha's Outstanding Performance Award back for my 2014 article, where I predicted the catastrophe that Petrobras has become, that they were facing a perfect storm. That was largely due to the scandals they had, the overspending and mismanagement, and the corruption, but also the structural change in oil pricing and the coming flood of oil on the market.
Interesting.
And those factors, especially the change in paradigm brought on by shale oil, have helped us reach the point now where we are in the beginning of the liquidation phase of oil.
Interesting. You don't think that lower interest rates and things like that can help oil prices?
Well, they can help oil prices, and we will see some spikes in oil prices. But for one thing, we have many alternate energy sources these days, non-fossil fuel or fossil fuel derived even, but between solar, small-scale geothermal, wind in localized projects, conversion of natural gas or coal to synthetic crude oil, technologies that have been around since they ran the German World War II military machine was run on synthetic crude. So these aren't new technologies, although there are new facets to them. All of these are economic in the $70 to $80 a barrel range. If the oil crash hadn't come, the alternatives would have soon become major factors in limiting oil prices. The alternative prices continue to fall. Solar has reached the point for many types of projects where it's actually competitive to conventional electric power generation projects where not on a kilowatt-hour basis per se, but when you have to invest the sunk cost of an entire electrical plant, solar has you can scale it to the smaller size project to be additive rather than having to incrementally build a massive plant. So solar's already become economic, directly economic competitive on many instances, and is continuing to fall in price. And we're seeing that in other alternative prices. And we also have, of course, regulatory concerns, environmental and geopolitical issues that are putting pressure on us to move away from oil. So all those combined to limit of oil, and shale oil has intensified the pace at which when there's a spike in demand for oil, that shortfall in production at any given moment can be responded to, and we can rise production to meet that demand. Back in my active days in the oil industry, it was 15 years to 20, even 20 years at some time points for a full cycle to bring online a major new energy source of millions of barrels of oil, an offshore oil field, for instance, from the time of initial exploration until you made a discovery and planned the development and built the, got the permits and the, built the platforms and towed them out, put them in place, drilled the wells, got the gathering system to bring the oil and gas onshore to process it and market it. It was a 15-year lead time. So there were, once we reached a shortage and prices soared, it took several years before we had the additional capacity to moderate those prices again. Shale oil has completely changed that. Shale oil, we've got the capacity to bring on multi-million barrels in months rather than years. So we're not going to see that strong upward pressure in the future. And it's also broken the back of cartel pricing, which was part of what kept us with stable, higher-end energy prices.
Interesting segue there. Okay, so no oil and gas companies, but what do you like, especially right now?
Some of the things we like right now are the consumer staples, General Mills, Clorox, Procter & Gamble, a lot of the classic households, widows and orphan type stocks that are known for their solid dividends and tend to be somewhat recession-proof because they are consumer staples that need to be bought every 30 to 90 days. I am cautiously and continue to earn off of a Caterpillar and Honeywell, excuse me, and there's another one in that I can't think of at the moment, but the industrial base for heavy machinery serving especially the Chinese market is very good. And there's, of course, that level of tension there with China and trade, which again brings us to our technique where we can write at prices below market to build in a market crash, or, well, not truly a full crash, but a strong decline in market, so we can get paid to wait at 15-20% below current prices in some cases, like these. We can get paid a good option premium yield to wait for prices to lower to those costs before we make an entry point. We're quite comfortable in that regard for things like that. Couple of other things I like right now. We've been making good money off of a few special interest situations. Sprint. Sprint's been delayed over a year now on their merger with T-Mobile.
Yeah.
We've been making very good money writing the cash secured puts on that. Basically, Sprint's going to be bought out for about about $8 a share, $8.25, I think. And I've been writing $7 a share cash secured puts with a strike price of $7 a share since May of this year. And I roll forward now to where we're into March of next year. I've harvested a total of $2.16 in premiums cash in my pocket to date, on an initial covering cash investment of $6.34. So I've got an absolute return on an absolute return of 34.1% on that covering cash in the 10 months I've been writing. That takes me out to March of next year. And on an annualized basis, that's 40.88%. And my break-even point's down to $4.84 at this point. It's not trading at what is Sprint currently is right around just under $6.
Can you walk our listeners through how one of these cash secured puts, how that whole strategy works?
Yeah, a cash secured put is, and when we write covered options, that means sells. And we're, sure. we're essentially selling options short. We're selling options. We do not own the option. That's the writing. We're creating a new option contract. We get to select the price that we're, and the strike price is the price we will be paid if the person who buys the contract wants to exercise his right. A put contract gives them the right, but not the obligation, to buy our stock from us at the specified strike price anytime during the contract period. And we write contracts generally anywhere from 15 days to 3 months forward, sometimes longer.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, on a sprint contract here with a cash secured put, I write a contract, I sell a put contract that gives them the right to sell me their stock mm-hmm. that they own for $7 a share, their sprint stock, during any period of the stock. In this case, my strike price is $7. The purchase of the buyout price of Sprint when the merger completes is 8.25. So I feel $7 is a fairly safe price. There is some regulatory issues, almost all of which have been settled. The federal government, both the FCC and the FTC and the Department of Justice have all signed off on the deal. Took a while, but got all their approvals. We still we have a litigation, a suit filed multi-state, initially by five states, joined by a few others, opposing it as anti-competitive. And again, this is they're taking the position it's anti-competitive, where the federal government, the federal agencies whose responsibility is to make that judgment, have reviewed it, and in their considered opinions, all of them have concluded it's a benefit to the public, not anti-competitive. So the states have a high hurdle in this lawsuit in order to convince a court that as a matter of law that the federal agencies are wrong, and that 44 states supporting the merger are wrong. It's almost impossible in my mind that they will the opposing states, the four opposing states, will prevail. But even if they do prevail, the stock still has value.
Yeah, sure.
My price has been placed all the way down at 484 now. The one who's the strongest valuation we have is in the case of a merger where another company has come forth and put their hard dollars up and their very careful and deep analysis with access to the books and management of the company, and they come to the conclusion the stock's easily worth 8.25 a share.
Right.
And when we have the price the shares were trading at before the merger was announced, which was about $5.50 a share. So on any of those numbers, I'm ahead of the game. So I've got good downside protection, and I'm earning a fantastic yield meanwhile.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay, this has been a very interesting conversation. If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as anywhere else you find podcasts, by searching for Marketplace Roundtable. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help others investors discover this podcast. I have been speaking with Richard Berger, who runs the Engineered Income Investing Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can sign up for Richard's service either by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Engineered Income Investing, or by typing Engineered Income Investing or Richard Berger into the site search bar at seekingalpha.com. You can also follow Richard on seekingalpha.com and enjoy his free content there. Okay then, thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.